call the docket.
Deacon MRE at Allegan Skies Enterprises, Inc., Life and Direct User, Bruce E. Parkman, Kevin J. Fox for the appellants, David C. Reinhardt, Kelly C. Bender, Edwin S. Brooks for the appellants.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Wyatt Durrett, and with me this morning is my partner, Kevin Funk. The issues in this case, I think, are fairly straightforward. The story began on December 11, 2008, the day after the complaint was filed in that original case, and there was a hearing for an emergency injunction. That was denied, and an order was entered. The plaintiff then filed what, in shorthand terms, we have referred to as a motion to reconsider, but in reality was something more. It was styled a motion to reconsider, set aside the order from December 11, 2008, or enter an order of non-suit. In the prayer for relief in that motion, it was virtually verbatim to the prayer for relief in the complaint, in that it asked for all of the same things that the complaint asked for, not just to reconsider the order from December 11th, but asking for different forms of damages, for other equitable relief, and then in the alternative, a non-suit. Out of that hearing came the critical order in this case, and it's December the 23rd of 2008. That order not only was styled a final order, that's what it was called, but the judge went a step further, and in the final sentence of the order said, this is a final order, and the case is removed from the docket. In response to the motion for a non-suit, the court denied that motion, saying that a non-suit motion could not be granted when the issues have been submitted to the court for disposition. Now, multiple times in the appellee's brief, that order is described as cosmetic, which I believe is a rhetorical way of trying to diminish the clear, unambiguous, and legally significant language of the order, which in our view determines the outcome of both issues.
May I ask you this? Was the December 11, 2008 hearing, was it really an evidentiary hearing on the ultimate merits of the case, the entry of a permanent injunction, or was it in the nature of a TRO or preliminary hearing, preliminary injunction hearing?
Your Honor, we do not have a record of that hearing. There was no transcript, and there's been no summary of the order submitted. And I will have to say that I did not attend that hearing, and so I am not able to tell the court exactly what took place at that hearing.
Well, that's at least one of my worries, is that to determine whether a trial judge does an appropriate non-pro-tunk, we need to know really what the trial judge is relying upon, and typically a statement of facts or transcript of the hearing that he or she is recording in an order is the best way to know that. Can we really answer the question of the non-pro-tunk order without having more information in the record about what actually occurred?
I think you can, and perhaps I should have inquired, and perhaps I should have the knowledge of what went on at that hearing, but I don't believe it's necessary. The court speaks through its orders, which is, as every justice on this court knows and we all know, is a standard that guides us in the practice of law, that we can know and rely upon what a court does because it speaks through its orders. The court entered in 2008 the order that I've described. a final order. Not only
the court later says it was final in the weirdest sense, I concede, but it's final only as to the temporary injunction request, and it was taken off the docket because there was nothing pending there to be heard. I agree completely, that's very odd, but suppose it was right and that language is just being misunderstood and he wants to make, or she wants to make, a clerical change to clarify it.
What happened in on February 9th of 2012 is clear from the record. The court at that time sought to correct that order and enter a corrected final order and change the meaning of the 2008 order. Our contention is that legally and lawfully the judge could not do that. Both parties had relied, but particularly our client, had completely relied upon that final order. And in proceedings that took place after 2008, after that order was entered, when our client's lawyer filed responsive pleadings and a counterclaim, the appellee's attorney filed a motion to dismiss those on the grounds that that was a final order. And so not only do we have the language of the final order, but we have the appellees filing a motion relying upon that being a final order, and that was the state of affairs from 2009 to 2012.
Do we have a transcript for the February 9 hearing or a statement of facts for the
February? I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Do we have a transcript or a statement of facts for the February 9, 2012 hearing?
We do not.
So, to summarize, your position, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the court denominated it as a final order. The opposing parties treated it as a final order. There is reliance upon it being a final order, and in the absence of a transcript or evidence to the contrary, it's a final order.
That's precisely our position.
Counsel, is there reliance on it being a final order if DMRE files an answer and a counterclaim on January 5th? So if the order is entered in December, and on January 5th, they're filing an answer and a counterclaim, so they're not treating it as a final order, at least not in January, are they?
Justice Powell, that is correct. We've offered a supposition as to why that happened. Mr. Rennie represented himself pro se and then hired a lawyer after the December hearings. However, once that happened, the appellee's attorney filed a motion to dismiss based on it being a final order.
Granted, this is the strangest case I've ever seen as far as procedure, but the parties at various times are treating it as final and at other points in time not treating it as final.
You're absolutely right, and I'm not attempting to dodge the fact that our client did file those pleadings. But after that happened, the final pleading that was filed by the appellees to dismiss what our client had done on the basis that it was a final order. And that was the state of affairs for 3 years. And very, very much to our client's detriment, he relied upon that being a final order and continued to treat the property as his, so that his potential exposure increased from $10,000 to over $600,000 based on the new complaint. That is the very definition of detrimental reliance. So if there is a weighing of what the parties did, the scales, I think, tilt heavily in our client's favor. But most importantly, more important than anything else in this case, in my mind, is the summation of our position by the Chief Justice. Courts speak through their orders. Regardless of what the parties do afterwards, that doesn't change what the court did. And the court entered a final order twice, said it twice. And most significantly, also denied the non-suit. And there was no basis for denying the non-suit other than that everything had been submitted to the court for disposition. And that is the clarion document in this case that I think controls everything else. So with that, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there are further questions.
David Reinhart, representing the appellee in this case, Caius Enterprises. I want to address first one of the questions that the court asked about that December 11, 2008 order. And I think that there's a clear answer to that order. What that order states occurred at the December 11, 2008 hearing is that the parties appeared to be heard on the plaintiff's motions for an emergency injunction. Evidence was presented and argued to the court. That was the only issue from the record that the appellants have elected to provide to the court in this appeal, that this court determined from its orders and from the record. So with that...
Well, what possible explanation would the trial court have to enter a final order when all it was really doing is denying a TRO?
Judge, I think the issue there is actually highlighted by the language of that final order. When that order says that it highlights why the nunk-pro-tunk actually occurred on February 9th, 2012, and I'd also like to go into the handwritten notes of the court. We know that this order, or at least have a very good idea that this final order of December 23rd, 2008 is referential to the December 11th, 2008 order. And we know that because the only thing that was ever heard by this court prior to the entry of this final order was encapsulated in that December 11th, 2008 order. When that order states that the motion of non-suit is denied because a non-suit may not be taken after the case has been submitted to the court for decision, we know that the only thing that it possibly could refer to, the inadvertence here, it highlights the inadvertence or the omission or error of the court when it decided to nunk-pro-tunk. In deciding that this was an incorrect final order, we know that it has to refer to the motion for emergency injunction when it says the case was submitted. Because what this court will not find is any record of the case being submitted, any of the merits of the case, the trespass or wrongful eviction causes of action that were contained in that complaint. It will not be there. There was no scheduling order entered. There was no trial set. There was no notice of hearing. And in fact, that order itself, the final order, it doesn't state that the parties appeared to be heard. It says that this day the court considered the plaintiff's motion for reconsideration, and admittedly, I think as everybody has acknowledged, this is a fairly odd situation. But
did the motion for reconsideration ask merely to reconsider the temporary injunction request, or did it ask, as Mr. Durrett suggested, to render judgment on the merits and enter a permanent injunction and all ancillary equitable relief?
Well, I believe that their summation of the motion to reconsider is correct. However, I would go back to the rules of this court. There is one action that can be filed, and that is by complaint. Whether or not the motion to reconsider asked for that other relief, that's the same relief that was asked for in the complaint. And I would raise the question...
But that doesn't help you, because if the trial judge is saying, look, it started off as a TRO, I denied it, that didn't mean anything. The case goes on to discovery and motion practice and trial. But if it starts off as a TRO and a motion to reconsider comes in and says, look, not only are you wrong on the TRO, but I'm asking right now for a permanent injunction and I want to rely on the evidence I've already put on, and the court denies that, then it's fleeted all the way to the end of the case and the case is over. And that's, I think, his argument. And why is that wrong?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And I think that goes to some of the issues that I've raised. But I'd like to briefly note on the nunk-pro-tunk issue that this court, in its handwritten notes and in their brief, the appellants do not dispute that these are the handwritten notes of the court. The court states there is an evidentiary hearing on February 9, 2012. There are no transcripts, no statement of facts. That is the appellant's election. But what we know is that from that hearing, whatever came out of that hearing, the court stated in its notes the final order is incorrect and will be amended as incorrect and incomplete. I'm not entirely sure what level of deference that should be given, and I think there's a question, is that a legal conclusion or is that really a finding of fact?
Or is that a confirmation that even the court thought the first order was the final order? It's in his own handwriting. There are ways to deal with an order that has been entered that is final and have it reconsidered.
Yes.
Scrivener's errors, fraud on the court, there's several ways that you can do that. If the court didn't think it was a final order, you could simply say that. Say, this order was improperly denominated as a final order. It did not dispose of all of the matters in the case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Or there's a scrivener's error if it was a final order. Or there was fraud on the case if there was a final order. None of that is that. They're even in his own handwriting.
And I agree, Your Honor. But I think that does arise, the inadvertence does arise from the referential nature of that final, the December 23rd, 2008 order to the December 11th, 2008 order. Because never was the case submitted to the court at any point. There was no evidentiary hearing. Despite the motion issue that was raised earlier, that motion was never actually heard. At least there is no record of it ever being heard on the merits. But then I would go back to what I think is a very important issue for this court to decide, and it has implications in both the non-pro-tunk argument and the res judicata argument, and that is, let's say that this order is indeed a final order, and it did indeed go to the merits. Can a court issue such an order if there are no responsive pleadings and there is no evidentiary hearing where the parties have been placed at issue?
Can the court do it? You mean, does the court have the power to do it? Yes, the court has the power to do it. Could it be an error? Yes, it could. So what do you mean by can the court do it?
Well, Your Honor, my point is that the court cannot. And to quote...
What do you mean? Tell me why not. Because they don't have the power?
Judge, Potts v. Mathias and Alkali Works specifically states, no court can base its decree upon facts not alleged, nor render its judgment upon a right, however meritorious, which has not been pleaded and claimed. A decree cannot be entered in the absence of pleadings upon which to found the same, and if so entered, it is void.
It's voidable, actually.
I understand.
But it's not void, because the court has subject matter jurisdiction, so it can't be void. It may be voidable because it's error. But it can't be void.
I understand that point, but I think going back to Singh v. Mooney, which is also cited in my brief, it raises other issues other than subject matter jurisdiction or jurisdiction over the parties. And it specifically says the distinction between an action of the court that is void ab initio rather than merely voidable is that the former involves the underlying authority of a court to act on a matter, whereas the latter involves actions taken by a court which are in error. An order is void ab initio if entered by the court in the absence of jurisdiction of the subject matter or over the parties granted, or if the character of the order is such that the court had no power to render it, or if the mode of procedure used by the court is one that it could not lawfully adopt. And my argument, Your Honor, is that if we were to treat this as a final order, it would essentially operate without the parties ever appearing to be heard, without the appellee, plaintiff below, being given his day in court, without being able to present evidence even on that motion.
Why didn't the plaintiff appeal? He files a motion for reconsideration. He goes to the merits, goes beyond the TRO context. Trial judge says, I've already heard all this, and there's nothing to this case. Paraphrasing, I have no idea what the truth is. The right answer to that is you shouldn't do that. I'm appealing.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I cannot explain why that did not occur. I don't know why that didn't occur. I only have the facts that I'm dealing with here. But the rules of this court do not allow, I would argue that this essentially operates as a summary judgment without any hearing whatsoever and without the parties being placed at issue.
Well, let's suppose exactly what you say is what happened, a clear error, and a final order is entered. Are you supposing that it could be challenged for the next 50 years as void? irrespective of 1:1?
If the court adopted a procedure that it could not lawfully adopt in accordance with the court rules, summary judgment cannot be, and I think it's hard to characterize what that order is, but for some purposes, I think it may be best characterized as a summary judgment.
I agree with you. I don't know if you're following the chief's question. Supposing everything you say is true, is an outrageous violation of our rules, but he did it. The trial judge did it. Isn't the right answer that unless it goes to a subject matter want of jurisdiction, that is power, the only way to fix it is to appeal? You can't wait and collaterally attack it after 1:1 is expired.
Well,
what's wrong with that logic?
The logic is sound, but I think that the logic on the other side is sound as well. And as the quote from Singh v. Mooney that this court ruled on earlier, it is not solely subject matter jurisdiction or jurisdiction of the parties that can make something void. If the order is something that the court could not lawfully adopt, and I'm arguing that the court could not lawfully adopt that order, it could not lawfully have taken any of that action without the parties being at issue, then it is void, ab initio.
So it could be collaterally attacked ad infinitum forever?
I believe that it could.
Mr. Reiner, do you know what's fascinating about this whole appellate process generally? Is that lawyers come to the podium, generally speaking, with one case. But appellate judges look at the case being presented, and they're thinking about thousands of cases. They're thinking about what is the future implication if I agree with this position. I may, I'm not saying that I do, but I may agree with everything you've just said except the void ab initio part. And say, you know, this wasn't handled properly. This isn't right. But I also may understand that if I decide this case, if my position is in your favor, that I have just muddled up for the rest of the future use of these rules and these cases, the whole question of rule 1:1 finality, subject matter jurisdiction, void ab initio versus voidable. And I said, how can the court actually rule in your favor without casting doubt on all of the principles that we followed in the Commonwealth about those subjects?
Well, Judge, for the sake of time, I will move on to, I think, what may be possibly a more important issue as far as the appellee is concerned, and that is the issue of res judicata. Because the court can still find that the appellants are correct on the non-pro-tunk issue, and my client would still be able to technically proceed with his case below. And the question that...
I was thinking as you made your arguments for 13 minutes that you're making really good arguments on assignment of error 2. And I was wondering why they were all on assignment of error 1.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I think they kind of muddled together. I argue the void issue, the voidness issue in the res judicata argument. But the biggest argument is there actually... a determination on the merits in this case. And on that order, and I would go back to Scales v. Lewis, that was a case where there was a general district court ruling. The court could have, on a warrant of debt, marked various things, could have marked judgment for plaintiff, judgment for defendant. The court didn't do any of those things. The court just dismissed the case. In this December 23rd, 2008 order, it does not dispose of the respective rights of the parties. It does not determine the rights of the parties in the premises. So it did not dispose of any of the merits of the law claims or law causes that were in that December 10th, 2008 complaint. And I think that is probably, it's hard to find an analogous case to this one, but I think that's probably the closest analogous case to the nature of that order.
I hope we never have a case that's analogous to this one.
I do as well, Your Honor. But at the end of the day, the court did not enter judgment in favor of any party except as to the emergency injunction, which, as the court knows, the main element to be considered there is whether there is a likelihood to succeed on the merits, not the merits themselves. And then there's no evidence that the merits were actually considered from the face of that order. The court simply did not dispose of the rights of the parties. And I think if the court were to apply res judicata, from a public policy standpoint, on this technical issue, when it is absolutely clear from the record that there was no trial on the merits, that these rights of the parties were not litigated, then it would mean that on a technicality, litigants would not be given their day in court. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that the judgment, on at least on the res judicata issue and the non-pro-tunk issue, be affirmed.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal.
I concentrated on assignment of error number one because, in our view, it also controls assignment of error number two.
How can that be if, upon the view of look at the whole record, there really was no decision on the merits other than the one very narrow issue that was decided on December 8th or December 11th or whatever the day is?
That is the critical
question. I think you're going to tell us.
Well, I'm going to try. That is the critical question. In order to answer that question, let me put clearly before the court what was asked for in the motion to reconsider, because that has been the topic of discussion.
Does it matter what was asked for?
I do think, I think it does matter, because one of the issues is what was, when the court decided that it was not going to grant the non-suit, and that's the important part of the order for these purposes, I think, it said the matter has been submitted to the court for disposition. That means that the court has before it everything that it is going to decide in this case, so there is nothing left to non-suit.
How did it decide those issues, though? It doesn't say in its order a judgment for anybody.
I don't think it has to say judgment for anybody under the circumstances of this case. It is a final order. By definition, the final order, even without the language about the non-suit, the case is over. Everything has been decided. There's nothing further to do.
If you realize the burden of persuasion was on your opposing counsel on assignment of error one, but assignment of error two, the burden of persuasion is on you. So if we look at this final order, so-called final order of December 23, and we can interpret it one or two ways, one on the just resolving the TRO and making some casual and erroneous statements about the case going off the docket, or two, resolving all the merits, including a permanent injunction request in the complaint. If it's not clear, the burden of proof is on the party asserting res judicata to establish that the merits were rendered, were addressed by a final judgment. So how can you hurdle that burden of persuasion?
I don't think it's unclear, Justice Kelsey. And I don't deny that we have a burden of persuasion. But I would submit to the court that there really is only under our rules and the principles that govern our interpretation of orders, there is only one interpretation.
And that's mostly because the judge said, I deny your non-suit because I've already got to the merits.
Yes.
Well, suppose he was wrong.
It wasn't appealed. As you pointed out, that the burden was on the appellees after that order was entered and denominated a final order, and the motion for non-suit was denied. And subsequently, three weeks later, the appellees treated it as a final order. They could have cured this by appealing, and they didn't.
Right. No, not suppose he was wrong that this was a final order, but suppose he was wrong that reaching the merits of a TRO is the same thing under non-suit practice as reaching the ultimate merits to preclude the non-suit. He just misunderstood the non-suit statute. Isn't that possible, given all the other mistakes in this procedural record?
Well, as has been commented on, this is a highly unusual case, and there's no question about that. And yes, is the answer to your question. Given the way this case unfolded, there are any number of possibilities. But I would submit to the court that the first rule in the rules of this court has to do with the finality of orders. Everyone treated this as a final order for years until 2012.
You've gone a long way with that argument. The question now is, did this final order that can't be nunk-pro-tunk later render a final judgment on the factual merits? That's the question.
That is the question. And that is when I started with my rebuttal. I was going to read the clause in the motion to reconsider, but the court can do that, so I don't have to read that clause. You can read that clause. That was identical to the prayer for relief in the complaint. That put everything before the court. That's in the record. and the court felt that everything was before it, and it had it. It had it to decide, and therefore it could not grant the non-suit. Now, I don't think there's any other interpretation to that order than that this court, that court, at that time, thought that it had everything before it, and it decided everything and entered a final order. And I would suggest to the court that, as the court has questioned, is there a what point in time do those events change? If a court saying, I cannot grant a non-suit because everything is before me for disposition, and in the motion pending before the court, everything in fact was before the court for disposition.
But the same trial court years later said, no, that's not exactly what happened. We just messed this file up. Sorry, I'll try to fix the final order. Nobody got to the merits, the ultimate merits in this case. So let's just take it from here. I mean, that's the way I read the last chapter of this saga. Is that unfair?
I think it is improper legally to allow a court years later to go back and undo what is facially clear and the parties have relied on for over 3 years.
Would that be because without an appeal and without a clarification at the time, it becomes the law of the case? Does that become a part of this or not? The law of the case is that this was decided on the merits. Is that part of this case on appeal?
But to be candid, I hadn't thought about it that way, but an unappealed ruling by the court, yes, I think it would become the law of the case.
I guess I don't understand what you mean. I don't understand that.
Well, okay. Some of us have taken these concepts further.
Out of space.
Call the next case.
Would you leave breadcrumbs for me?